Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is Zero Point Radio Show. Thank you to BBS Radio and my co-host, James Moffitt from Toronto. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Good, Chris. How are you?
Yeah, good. I thought today I had a letter, and I'm going to just read the note and email and kind of launch from that onto a talk for a little while. Dear Christopher, what is the point of life here on Earth? What should we be doing with ourselves? Is education the key to higher existence? Is working for companies people who you know lie to society about what their products can do for you for money the right thing to do so that you can take care of yourself and families? What is the point of life? Okay, so I thought I'd discuss this from the perspective of the Gurdjieff teaching and esotericism in general. What is the purpose of life? And I'd like to just recount a story told about Gurdjieff, and I've mentioned this story before, but I think it's very significant. And Gurdjieff lived in France in the early 1920s, and he had an institute there. And he had a young houseboy, Fritz Peters, who later wrote a book called Boyhood with Gurdjieff. Anyway, this is a story from the book, and Peters... Gurdjieff asked the boy one day what was outside of the window, and there was a big oak tree. And Gurdjieff asked Fritz Peters how many acorns there were on the tree. And Peters responded that there were thousands. The Gurdjieff then inquired as to how many of those acorns were likely to become oak trees. The boy guessed that perhaps five or six, or maybe not even that many. Gurdjieff then explained the essential nature of his teaching by comparing it to the possibilities that nature provides. So here's then the story, or Gurdjieff's explanation. Perhaps only one, perhaps not even one, must learn from nature. Man is also organism. Nature makes many acorns, but possibility to become tree exists for only few acorns. Same with man. Many men born, but only few grow. People think this waste, think nature waste. Not so. Rest become fertilizer, go back into earth, and create possibility for more acorns, more men, once in a while more tree, more real man. Nature always give, but only give possibility. To become real oak or real man must make effort. You understand this, my work, this institute, not for fertilizer, for real man only, but must also understand fertilizer necessary to nature. In West, your world, is belief that man have soul, given by God. Not so. Nothing given by God. Only nature give. And nature only give possibility for soul, not give soul. Must acquire soul through work. Even your religion, Western religion, have the phrase, know thyself. This phrase most important in all religions. When begin know self, already begin have possibility become genuine man. So first thing must learn is know self. If not do this, then will be like acorn that not become tree. Fertilizer. Fertilizer which go back in ground and become possibility for future man. So here's the answer to the first part of the lady's question, what is the purpose of life? In the Gurdjieff teaching, or an esotericism in the way the purpose of life is for us to acquire our souls. That to acquire our soul means to attain some possibility with latent within us, but which otherwise might be lost. So the acorn can become fertilizer and feed the earth. Similarly, we might become fertilizer and feed the earth, and the decay of the body go into the earth, and other elements within us might feed nature. But there is the possibility of attaining our souls. So for Gurdjieff, this requires work. This requires effort. He says the evolution of consciousness cannot happen mechanically. It requires efforts on our part. It can't happen unconsciously. Instead, we need to make effort to know ourselves and to wake up. And in the Gurdjieff teaching, he says most people know only the state of relative consciousness, or what he calls waking sleep. So we're half self-conscious. But the formation of our personality becomes what Gurdjieff calls our false personality. And that obscures our essence, which is our underlying inner nature. So Gurdjieff explains that modern man, in a way, becomes such a superficial organism with so much false ego, false personality, that he doesn't attain to his essence and develop in his essence. And the essence is associated with Gurdjieff, with the state of what he calls self-consciousness. We want to attain to the state of self-consciousness. And that, for Gurdjieff, means to attain our own I. That, in a way, there is an I within us, a higher dimensional I, or some entity I within us. And we want to attain to that level, or to realize that nature within ourselves. So self-knowledge, knowing ourselves, begins with kind of knowing our personality and studying ourselves and our habits and our lives and observing our thoughts and feelings and actions and striving to wake up to eventually. What happens is there's a disillusion of that false consciousness system and the emergence of the essential consciousness. And this is associated with the awakening of the higher emotional center, or is associated with the heart. So I would say the awakening of the heart is the most first and essential awakening to self-consciousness. The self within all the mystical literature is associated with the heart. Krishna says, I am the self seated within the hearts of all living beings. For Blavatsky, we have the monad, which is associated with the heart. In the stanzas of Dan, she explains, the suns expand and contract through their own selves and hearts. So our I is within the heart. So sometimes self-realization is defined as the disillusion of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. That's from Ramana Maharshi, defines yoga. So we want to awaken to this essential heart consciousness. And we want to attain our souls. So for Gurdjieff, that means we have to attain to this state of self-consciousness. And he explains that people think they already know self-consciousness, but really it's the false consciousness based on their learning and conditioning and their false personality system. So we have to awaken within this essential, within our essence, and attain self-consciousness and attain our own I. And another way in which Gurdjieff talks about attaining the soul, he talks about the development of what he calls the higher being bodies. That we don't only have a physical body, but we have an astral or Kesjan body, and then we have a mental body. So we have these higher being bodies, and we want to attain to the level of these higher being bodies, and that provides for the continued evolution of the soul through different lives during the life of the solar system. Gurdjieff says, according to what higher being bodies you develop, that determines the length of your life, in a sense. That if he says that you have your physical body, and when you die, your physical body returns to the earth. He explains that certain vital energies return to the moon, connected to the soul energy. So some people, he says, as souls, are drawn to the moon, into the lower world. Okay, other entities, he says, at death, they rise into the atmospheres, that the astral worlds are within the atmospheres surrounding the planets, surrounding the earth, and that's where planetary influences act upon the atmospheres. So there's afterlife within the atmospheres of the planet. And he says the mental body he associates with the level of the sun. So it is the solar intelligence within ourselves, the illumination of the mind. So in a way we want to attain to the level of the sun, and in a way the soul then is connected between these two worlds. You have the higher worlds, which culminating in the sun, and then you have the lower world, which is like passage to the moon. So the souls, we can become fertilizer and return to feed the earth and moon, or we can become oak trees, in which case we develop the higher being bodies and have continued existence through the subtle planes after death and even through different lives. Gurdjieff explains that if a person attains their mental body, they become, quote, immortal within the limits of the solar system. Okay, so that they've crystallized the mental body, then they'll have continued life through the time period of the evolution of the solar system. So that's a very long life. So Gurdjieff explains that in a way the evolution of humankind, it can happen, but it happens over immense periods of time. And he says for the masses of humanity, in a way we can't wait for the evolution of humankind, because that's such a long, long process. And that what we really need to be concerned with is the individual awakening and evolution. So, coming back to the question, what is the purpose of life? In a way, the purpose of life is to attain our souls and to develop certain qualities and potentials within ourselves. We want to attain real I. In Aleister Crowley's Magic, he says the first principle of magic is that every man and woman is a star. So the idea is that we all have that star element, or that God spark, or divine spark, or the monad, or the jiva atma, different terms for this entity in different literature. That we all have such a divine spark within us. So in life, we want to attain to that. We want to evolve, to awaken to these higher faculties that are latent within us. So what is the purpose of life? The purpose of life is the evolution of the soul. So we strive to know ourselves and develop our higher being bodies to attain our soul. And in life we can see how many people in a way lose their souls. It's very interesting how in the system of seven chakras in the human being, the heart chakra is the central chakra, and you have three below that and three above that. Most people are essentially controlled by the three lower chakras. If your orientation to, towards life is purely towards the physical, then you're controlled by the first three chakras, often associated with the motives of money, sex, and power. So we see how mechanical life is so controlled by money, sex, and power. We see this in all the violence and everything that happens on politically and financially in our countries, and the activities of those, the elites who strive so adamantly for money, sex, and power. And in a way, it's like the saying, what does it benefit a man to gain the whole world but to lose your soul? Okay, so in a way, the level of the heart is the first level beyond the three lower chakras, which correspond to the physical aspect of a human being. So we want to attain to the level of the heart and awaken in the heart. And you see in many different judgment books, like you can go back to ancient Egypt, and you see what is weighed at death. It is the heart that is weighed. And in other Islamic and other religious teachings, you find that it's what's weighed at death is the heart, or what's examined is what is within the heart. So we have to attain to our souls, and that the soul isn't automatically given to a human being, but it has to be attained through our own efforts towards awakening and acquiring these higher faculties. The idea also is that we as human beings do not realize all the hidden powers that we might acquire through such awakening and attainment. I remember 30 years ago when I began studying esotericism, and I read an article by Swami Prabhupada, and he was talking to a scientist, and he was talking about, you scientists, you think you're so smart because you can blast off in a rocket ship and land, you know, a little capsule up on the moon and return, and what an amazing physical accomplishment that is. But then he says, but a yogi can transfer himself using his siddhis or psychical powers to the planets of the material sky as well as to planets in the spiritual sky. And think of how amazing possibilities that would be, that if we could transfer ourselves through space and time to the planets, or even beyond the level of the sun into the larger galaxy, to planets in the spiritual sky. So if human beings actually had such latent faculties, and these might have been hidden from us, as I think many things have been hidden from us. So, coming back to the letter, where did I put the letter here? First aspect, that is the point of life. As I would say, and as I try to live my life, I strive towards my own possible evolution. And also to help those who you have contact with and who you live with and people around you, to help towards their own striving for self-perfection. It's another term Gurdjieff uses, is the striving for self-perfection in terms of being, he says. Okay, then the lady, what should we be doing with ourselves? In what I study, I try to remember to self-remember, which is the main practice in the Gurdjieff teaching. So as I go about my life, I remember to make efforts to wake up and to be more fully present and conscious and breathing and present at different points through my day, to stay in that state of heightened wakefulness. Is education the key to higher existence? Modern education is really an obstacle to higher existence. most of what one is taught in modern science and philosophy and psychology and religion, in a way, is misleading and takes a person astray. So often people who are educated are even at a disadvantage, as they're so full of false knowledge that they've acquired from outside of themselves. Certainly going through, I was within the university system for approximately 25 years, 12 years as a student, getting my BA and MA and PhD, and then about 11, 12 years as a university professor. And through all my time in within the educational system, I found that there's no psychology of the soul. It's not even considered. And there's no study of esoteric teachings. There's no study of the nature of human consciousness. There's no study of paranormal or psychical phenomena. All these areas have been excluded from the mainstream university education. So people have no knowledge in these areas. It's remained outside of the mainstream. So modern education really provides nothing towards the development of the spiritual or psychical nature of human beings. Is working for companies people who you know lie to society about what their products can do for you for money, the right thing to do so that you can take care of yourselves and families? It's a very hard question, and there's many people in ways work for companies and corporations who you know, intentionally poison and sicken people and involved in monstrous things in the war industries and the military industrial complex. So much of this is really so evil, what's been done within our society. And people do sell their souls. You see how these elites and the politicians and the radio and TV personalities and stuff, all these people sell their souls. They make so much money and have such wealth and abundance and fine clothes and everything they want. But in a way, what underlies their activity is so monstrous. In a way, they sell their souls. And sometimes, and it's hard to make a judgment for an individual person, you know, how bad are the products that you're selling? You know, are they ones you know are intentionally used to poison people or just have some adverse effects, you know, and then what is the situation of your family? It's a problem is that so many people sell their souls and do things that are a waste and poisonous and disastrous for others. So these are things from a mystical perspective. We don't want to accumulate bad karma. So karma is the effects of our actions bring about a reaction. So at some point things have to be equally balanced before everything adds up to zero again and you go back into the nothingness. So karma, in a way, is a cosmic law based in the physics of creation. So the things you do, in a way, you know, we do have consequences and we'll have to pay for the consequences of our own actions. It's like in America today, in the countries of the world, it's like we've been so asleep and all of a sudden now we're going to have instant karma come down upon us. We've allowed our societies to be taken over by such criminal elements and this has permeated our society. And it's like a psychical disease and the level of the human psyche has been degraded intentionally by these elites, by their deceptions and such. So many people are in such situations and it's always hard to judge a circumstance of for people. But generally we need to keep in mind what does it benefit us if we gain the material world and have such wealth but don't attain our souls. I've not seen any U-Haul vans behind that takes you to the graveyard behind a hearse. No one gets to take their possessions with them at death into the afterlife. Like, you're then beyond the material. So all your wealth means nothing to you. So what we all need to strive towards our own development of our being, our own awakening and self-realization. So, and that's how I see psychology. Psychology is the science of the soul. That's the ancient meaning of the word psychology. But that understanding or definition has been lost for over a century in modern times. This understanding has been kept from people. People have been dummied down. And education hasn't fostered the development of the higher spiritual nature of human beings. In fact, it does exactly the opposite. It creates more false personality and dogmas and imaginary ideas. Gurdjieff talks about destroying without mercy all the rubbish accumulated through centuries of human mentation. So we have all this rubbish accumulated within the universities and the education, but so little of it has anything to say to the essence of a human being. So that's generally the idea of the Zero Point Radio Show, is I'm trying to explain the heart doctrine. The idea that we do have individual eyes or elements within the higher dimensional physics of the heart, and the zero point hypothesis, that this element is down at a zero point level, like there's a human being has a zero point center, and this is tied into the physics of what you are as a being. In a way, we are a being that comes down out of higher dimensions of space-time into the material body. So we inhabit the material body. But upon the death of the body, the spiritual soul continues its existence. Okay, so those are a few of my comments on trying to look at those issues. And Jim, I'll open up. Did you have any comments or things you'd like to add?
Who is the letter from?
Well, I won't say the person's name.
But it was sent to you by somebody who was responsible to the program, or
No, it doesn't really say.
Oh, okay.
I just read the letter. I'm not sure if she might have come across my website or the show or on YouTube or somewhere. Come across. A number of people seem to contact me who've seen the YouTube series done on my Coast to Coast appearance. Have you ever listened to that?
No, I haven't, no.
I think that I've been on Coast to Coast twice. The last time I was on was the best radio interview I'd ever done. Oh. And it's in, I guess, 8 parts, each about 10 minutes, because I was on for 2 hours of radio time, which is like you do it in 20-minute segments, 20 minutes on air, 10 off. So you do 2 20-minute sessions per hour. So that's 80 minutes in 2 hours. And it's a series. The links are available at the website, www.zeropoint.ca. Yeah, I was very, very pleased with that radio interview.
Yeah.
Well, so would you like to add anything? Coming back, I've taken this question of what is the purpose of life? How would you like to respond to that? We're influenced by the same teachings very much. And Jim? Okay, I'm not sure if I've lost Jim here or if I'm on.
BBS Radio.
Okay, sorry, we had some interruption there.
Yeah, that was really...
Yeah, we lost Jim on the show.
That was really strange. Somebody phoning to sell me something somehow got through to my line. I'm not sure how that happened. Anyway, one thing I was going to say was that just in terms of education, you know, the real meaning of education, the root of the word, is to bring out that which is within, which in a sense is that, it refers to this idea of realizing that potential, realizing those hidden dimensions beyond what we normally understand ourselves to be. So in a sense, that really is what education is. And then I like the analogy, as I say, to the oak tree and the Gurdjieff story, because it's such a profound idea. I mean, it's something so kind of familiar, but at the same time mysterious in a sense, is like these acorns, you know, in this acorn is the potential to be an oak tree.
Yeah. Which,
when you think of it, you know, that's an acorn, but it could be an oak tree, you know, given time and favorable circumstances, certain developments. This is going to be an oak tree, which is really quite amazing. So it's going to be something much more complex and completely different what it is in potential and in its seed form. And in a sense, that's the miracle that lies in self-transformation through the study of oneself and through self-realization and knowing thyself, which is, it's a profound...
Yeah,
it's such a simple idea, but it's so completely misunderstood and not recognized for how profound it is.
Yeah. People, I think that it means knowing their ordinary personality.
Right.
And it kind of begins with that and self-study, but then there's a transformation and the self you know, come to know, is something quite different than what you thought you were.
Well, that gets actually back to a point that, and I think you're right about knowing yourself, sort of your superficial, like your likes and your dislikes and your proclivities and your tendencies and in some way who you are, who you think you are. But in a sense, that's the something we touched on last week about systematic self-study is different from just normal self-observation or normal self-knowledge, in the sense that it is a study of yourself and it is the observation of yourself, but it's conducted within the context of a set of ideas which are intended to reveal to you that you're not what you think you are, and to begin to acquire a new understanding of yourself. And in that sense, that's one of the interesting, fascinating things about the fourth way teaching, is that you study yourself and the actual act of observing yourself to try to understand how you might be asleep. Just as a hypothesis, is in and of itself, it's a method of self-transformation, in the sense that certain things, in light of these new ideas, and I mean that sort of metaphorically and also in almost, it won't, in a sense, alchemically or metaphysically, in light of these ideas, things change. Things that happened before begin to drop away because of this light that you throw on yourself by studying yourself systematically. And that's something that's completely, I would say, has completely escaped Western philosophy and Western education since the Enlightenment. I think there's a general lack of recognition of the idea of self-study and of systematic self-study and how it can transform your understanding of the nature of self and how it can reveal the illusions of consciousness. And in the history of Western psychology, early in the development of what's academic psychology, there was a school called the introspectionists who tried to study their consciousness and themselves by introspecting and observing various aspects of their conscious life. But introspectionism sort of died a rather quick death, because all they sort of observed was certain processes, and they didn't really have any kind of great insights into what these were. Like, they were able to identify thoughts and feelings and emotions and sensations and images as a contents of consciousness, but they never went beyond
beyond that observation to any kind of systematic organization. And what they really didn't recognize was that consciousness, they couldn't see consciousness for what it is, which is something which is variable, something not just that flows like in the idea, the metaphor of the stream of consciousness, but that consciousness itself can be changed by becoming self-conscious. You can have a qualitatively different conscious state. And that's like the big failing of modern psychology, is in the sense that with the introspectionists, when they were dismissed, it was just the idea of self-observation as a scientific principle was dismissed too, and nobody seemed to have recognized that self-observation in and of itself is a very sophisticated technique that you can't just sort of conduct willy-nilly and you know, on your own without any special training. You have to have some sort of system to organize things, and that's sort of the genius of, it is the genius of esotericism, is that esotericism always involves a systematic approach to the study of oneself and to the study of one's consciousness, with the aim of transforming oneself and one's consciousness.
And it's also interesting how it said, like, esoteric ideas, in a way, come to us from outside of life.
Yeah.
That they're not like how you're describing the introspectionist. They tried to introspect and kind of discover within themselves how things work. Whereas it said esoteric teachings come to us from either people who've awakened and attained these levels of development, or they come from outside of life, from higher conscious sources. Like Gurdjieff talks about A, B, and C influences, and like A influences are like esoteric teachings which come from outside of life. And then these are stepped down into kind of B influences, which are philosophies and psychologies and religions and ideas which reflect some of that truth of the A influences. And then there are C influences, which are all the influences of everything around us in life. The education, the media, the news, the whole conditioning, external influences, C influences. So the idea that there are actually higher teachings, I mean, that's why we strive to understand esoteric teachings. They're ideas that which, when we begin to study them, are beyond us. But it's kind of a path to try to understand and grasp what is taught within esoteric teachings. Because esoteric teachings can't just be grasped with your ordinary mind in the ordinary way. Instead, you have to have the experience connected to that, the experience of what's being pointed to. You probably must have some line, Jim, on what is the meaning of life. What would Woody Allen say? I was expecting a quip.
Something like, I'm not sure if I believe in an afterlife, but I'm taking along a change of underwear just in case. Something like that. I don't know. I like, the meaning of life, geez. There is a Woody Allen line that I like when he's searching, he thinks he's going to die, and I think it's in Hannah and her sisters, and he's going around to all the different religious groups seeking answers to the meaning of life, goes to see his parents, and, you know, he says to them something to the effect that, you know, you must have examined these questions, you know, like, why are there Nazis, you know, and his father says, how the hell do I know why there are Nazis? I don't know how the toaster works or the telephone or something to that effect. And like, but the idea is kind of like, there's so much wiseacring going on all the time by people about the meaning of life and the meaninglessness of life in the current climate of secular thought, and, you know, people like Dawkins and Dennett and all these people, Carl Sagan, that say, you know, that we're just, you know, or Isaac Asimov, you know, we're just collections of atoms and molecules, and then with the dissolution of those, of the physical body, that's the end of us. There's no soul. And you know, these people are also convinced that, you know, because they know something about physics and chemistry, that, that they understand the meaning of life. But I mean, again, it's wiseacring, you know, that people don't know this. I mean, it's, these are huge questions. And in a sense, like, what's not recognized and what's really forgotten, this is sort of my main objection and yours to the whole debate about science versus religion, is that these are essential questions, but they didn't, you know, meaningful inquiry into them didn't begin 300 years ago with the age of reason and the Enlightenment with the rise of modern science. You know, people have been examining these questions for thousands and thousands of years, and really, in studying themselves systematically in the esoteric tradition, people have been, I think, approaching these questions in the most meaningful way, which is to you have to know yourself to know the universe and the gods, as the Greek, the Delphic Oracle, that was the maxim engraved over there, over the arch and the Delphic Oracle in Greece, is that you to know yourself, you know, man know thyself and thou wilt know the universe and the gods. I mean, that's an incredibly profound statement, which on some level seems kind of poetic and metaphorical, but I think that's literally true, that's my understanding of it after all these years of studying esoteric teachings, is that, yes, if you really did know yourself, you would know the universe, you would know the gods, which is, you know...
Yeah, you can actually have, like, experiences of cosmic consciousness.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
Yogananda's experience. He actually experienced his consciousness kind of expanding to embrace the universe and kind of realizing all of it was within himself.
Yeah.
Somehow. He was interconnected to the whole.
Yeah, and if we knew this, like, this self that, you know, that we so easily can talk about, but which we really don't know. There's a quote from Hazrat Inayat Khan, in this mechanism of the world, all that happens, all that is experienced in the way of thought and feeling is accumulated. Where? In the heart of God. The heart of man is one of the atoms which form the heart of God.
Wow, how beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the heart of God and the human being's heart is an atom of the God heart.
The heart of God, yeah. And
that's like in the Gnostic Gospels where Christ says, you sons of interior knowledge, say then from the heart that you are the perfect day, and in you dwells the light which does not fail, which is of the Father and of his pleroma. Again, yeah, so what nice quote that was, boy, about the human heart is an atom of the God's heart. Yeah.
I remember, too, like, when you're talking about Swami Prabhupada talking to the scientist, and he says at one point, like, the spaceships of modern science are like childish playthings compared to the powers of yogis. Childish playthings are always really like that, and it's like, you know, the idea that if you really knew yourself, if your knowledge of the interior dimensions of reality was as, you know, was as developed as your knowledge of the exterior material dimensions of reality, then you would be able to, you wouldn't need to be shooting up to the, you know, in a rocket ship to travel to the moon. You know, you could go to the planets, or in Yogananda's experience, you could be everywhere and nowhere. You know, you could have an experience of cosmic consciousness
You could acquire different faculties.
That's the other thing too.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of intermediate stages in this, in terms of like developing, acquiring these higher faculties and knowing these different worlds. And this is like that. You know, the other thing is that as you develop consciousness, you realize that you penetrate the illusions of the material world, and you begin to realize that there is all these other worlds in which we live and have our being, but which we don't recognize because they're invisible to us, because we don't have the faculties of consciousness to apprehend them and to exist in them. So, and that's kind of what is repeatedly described in the esoteric literature as the development of consciousness, is the development of these faculties and the development of the powers to actually exist in these other worlds, which kind of overturns everything in modern thought, in the sense that we think we're just products of the, our our minds are just the products of these material processes in the brain, and yet, you know, the esoteric tradition suggests that's reality turned upside down. It's interesting too. I'm going to go back and try to find this. It's been a long time since I looked at this book, but last week you were sort of talking about that Kantian idea about the difference between reality as we perceive it and reality out there in the noumenal world, like the phenomenal world and the noumenal world is like, you know, we just because we see something as red doesn't mean that it's red. You know, it's our understanding of the world is always based on our perception of the world. In his book, Living Time, Maurice Nicol, who is a student of Gurdjieff and Uspensky, talks about the materialist worldview as being associated in the esoteric tradition with like a lower level of understanding, a lower level of consciousness. It's quite interesting how in modern science and secular thought in modern times, belief in materialism and belief in exclusively in materialism and the denial of any kind of spiritual reality is thought as being like the most educated, in terms of your question earlier about education, the most educated and knowledgeable perspective on these things is to subscribe to a materialist perspective, whereas in the esoteric tradition, this is seen as a lower level of mind, that this is all an illusion that's created by the lower level of mind and the lower level of consciousness and being, and that if in fact we were to develop our consciousness and being, we would be able to penetrate this illusion and see that the worlds beyond, the metaphysical realms beyond, which inform the material world and are the sources of consciousness and being.
Yeah, there's been no consideration in science that of human beings, how we could be multidimensional,
yeah,
and how there could be a multidimensional physics to us as living beings.
Yeah,
like they've not considered that. Like, and it. We were going to talk about Laszlo. One of the things he talks about, like where he talks about the body and how the kind of coherence in the body, that cells is somewhere in the body. How do they know how to differentiate? Like how there's a wholeness to the body, which suggests that there are information fields underlying the material energetic systems that inform them. That there are these zero-point fields, or fields within the Akasha, or the ether. And it reminds me, the example I wanted to bring this up is like, if I were to take a piece of paper and put a magnet underneath, and then sprinkle iron filings on top, and those iron filings would all line up in the pattern created by the magnet, which was underneath the piece of paper. Now, it's like the materialist is looking at this from above and sees all the iron filings lined up in the patterns they're lined up. And he thinks the causes of the lining up of the iron filings has to be as influences between themselves on that plane. Like there must be a mechanical explanation of why those filings all line up in that pattern. Whereas really what's causing it is this underlying field which is invisible, say, to us. Like if we were looking just from above and seeing the paper. So we see all the iron filings, and if we don't see the magnet underneath, then yeah, that's like the scientist. All he does is see the iron filings, all the cells in the human being, whereas he doesn't see the information fields which underlie that.
Yeah, and that's I didn't think I did a very good job of discussing that, but I was trying to approach that question last week. I'm actually on page 8 of Laszlo's Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos. He says that dynamic equilibrium calls for long-range, quasi-instantaneous connections throughout the organism. The extent of these connections and the speed with which they spread in the organism are far greater than scientists had hitherto suspected. Then he talks about, in the human body, there are 1 million B billion cells, which is more than the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Of the cell population, 600 billion are dying, and the same number are regenerating every day, over 10 million cells per second. The average skin cell lives for only about 2 weeks. Bone cells are renewed every 3 months. Every 90 seconds, millions of antibodies are synthesized, each from about 1,200 amino acids, and every hour, 200 million erythrocytes are regenerated. In the span of a year, 98% of the atoms that make up the organism are replaced as well. No substance in the body is constant, though the heart and brain cells endure longer than most. Yet these substances that coexist at a given time produce thousands of biochemical reactions in the body each and every second, and they are all precisely and almost instantaneously coordinated so that they maintain the dynamic order of the whole organism. And in a sense, like that's the conundrum, is that you have this enduring physical organism, which is really like we think of ourselves as like we have a physical body, but really the physical body is a complex of hierarchically ordered systems which are interrelated and coordinated. And we have really no understanding of how this occurs when we really look at it. Like, I mean, we think we know so much in terms of modern medicine and biology and everything, but really, the big question is that given that all of this is turning over in terms of material, like he said, you know, 98% of the body is turned over, like the atoms in the body, what exactly is the intelligence which maintains this order, which remembers, because our physical bodies have, we cut ourselves and we get a scar. That scar will persist for the rest of our lives. We have an operation, have something removed. It doesn't grow back in, even though the atomic structure has changed completely.
Yeah, all new cells, all new material. Yeah.
And at the same time, we have this kind of, some sort of program. It's like a program where we age so that when we, when human beings hit 30 or 40 or 50, with, given a certain amount of variability depending on environment and diet and variety of other things, but we can pretty much, determine that at 50, a human being's going to look quite different than they do at 20. And so, like, there's some sort of program built in there, too. So it's like, you have these multiple intelligences interacting, really, in the human body. It's like that Henry Miller said, had this great piece of graffiti on his wall, "Don't look for miracles, you are the miracle." And in a way, we are miracles. Our continued physical existence is a miracle, in a sense, because it's so incredibly complex what's going on. And as I say, when you really look at things closely, like, you just see sort of that materialist reductionist perspective is extremely useful in explaining and isolating various aspects of human biology and physiology, and it's, could be applied to a certain medical model, but it really doesn't answer the basic questions as to, what we are. Like, I mean, it really...
Explain how it all happens.
Yeah, it's very superficial in a sense.
Yeah.
And in light of that, I would, that's why I would argue so vehemently against the entirely material explanation of things. Is materialism, as Mario Beauregard, who wrote The Spiritual Brain, says, materialism is at a dead end in a sense. It's stalled. That's his term. It's stalled, I'd agree. Like, it can take us so far, and it really can, within that realm. I mean, it's a certain level of order and meaning, the materialist perspective, and it's incredibly complex, and we can understand incredible things. We can do all these things medicinally based on this understanding. But in terms of a comprehensive explanation of what a human being is, It's not an explanation, and it will never provide an explanation. So that when somebody like Dawkins argues that that we don't need a god or a spirit or anything to account for this, even within the modern scientific perspective, that's not right. I mean, that's just completely wrong. That would be my argument anyway.
It's certainly not a claim supported by any evidence.
Yeah, actual evidence.
It's not a scientific claim. I mean, it's a personal assumption or position, really, rather than the result of any kind of
Yeah, and it's based on you know, what we talked about last week on the what Popper calls promissory materialism, you know, that all eventually, you know, if we pursue a materialist perspective, we'll be able to explain all these things. But I just don't, for the life of me, I can't understand how anybody can maintain that, especially in terms of the history of 20th century physics, because really, the history of 20th century physics, everything in it points to the need to go to beyond a strictly materialist explanation, or at least the limitations of a materialist explanation of things, and that really we have to understand these fields of information, and we have to understand consciousness. We're going to understand, you know, the nature of material reality, how it arises, and that's really what's very fascinating about Laszlo's book about science and the re-enchantment of the cosmos, is that he provides a very, you know, very provocative interpretation of the quantum vacuum and how really the material plane is intimately interrelated to the quantum vacuum.
Yeah, everything is sustained by the underlying zero point fields.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You know, the fundamental dogma or teaching of Volume 2 of The Secret Doctrine, a volume called Anthropogenesis, which explains the origin and evolution of humankind. And the fundamental teaching in that is that the astral body forms before the physical.
Oh, okay.
So there's a formation in these kind of invisible fields below the physical level before the physical level is formed. So the astral forms before the physical.
So it's a metaphysical dimension in precedes a metaphysical body,
the
and a metaphysical
dimension
precedes the arising of the physical and the material plane.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is what Laszlo's saying, is you can't explain these phenomena simply on a material plane, seeing all these molecules as individual cells and bits which somehow communicate through external influences. Somehow there's a deeper underlying physics to it, that it functions as a whole, and there's fields of intelligence which sustain that physical body.
Yeah, and that's exactly what, you know, I mean, that's what the conundrums, as they say, in the materialist position, the limitations of the materialist position, I think, lead to that kind of the need for some sort of explanation beyond the physical, and that's where the esoteric tradition, there's already explanations as to how the body is maintained and how it's informed, you know, and I mean, this applies to consciousness and life in general, is that everything is a descent from these higher dimensions, higher dimensions through these higher being bodies. Like, again, what I was going to get at actually when we were talking about this earlier is that this is what I think is so interesting about the model that you've articulated, is that we have to understand that we're multidimensional beings in a multidimensional universe. Like, that's what I think is the thing that's most missing in almost every attempt to incorporate the ancient esoteric ideas and modern scientific knowledge. Like, even people who are sympathetic to that perspective, I don't think emphasize that enough. And I would even say that about Laszlo's book, is that in a sense it's kind of formatory, in the sense that he's talking about the vacuum and the material plane. But he doesn't have any kind of, there's no sort of recognition that I could see in his book of, like, the idea that there might be, you know, various levels of this, like, that I mean, in a sense,
the hierarchy we were mentioning.
The hierarchy,
yeah. The levels.
Yeah.
Yeah, within the ethers.
Yeah. And you know, this is where, like, in a way, he's clearly very sympathetic to the esoteric tradition, but it's not like he's really, it's more in the commentary in his book, actually, where you get a more informed perspective. I don't see where he's, you know, really quoted anybody or drawn on anybody, in a sense, and that's a bit of the problem I have with his work, is that I think he's, like you said last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago, he's really good
on explaining aspects of the quantum vacuum. It's like it's really an important book.
Yeah.
But I don't see that in his articulation of it, and that's what I see in your work, which I and the other part, of course, is the heart doctor.
Yeah, he does. I mean, he doesn't have the idea of a human being as having a zero point center. That's not in the book, even though he does have the idea that we live within zero point fields.
Yeah.
But he doesn't consider that we actually have such a center. And then he connects consciousness and mind mainly to the brain in the head in the human being. He doesn't consider that the whole human being, including the heart, might be responsible for this kind of multidimensional physics.
Yeah, and he makes reference, I found it a bit difficult understanding actually what he was saying in some places about holographs interacting with the Akashic field or the quantum vacuum, which he equates with the Akashic field. But there's no idea like the idea that you have developed about the idea that light, which originates in the heart, is the laser beam, is a reference, the laser beam which, you know, informs the holograph and the human being. Like, there's no recognition of that idea.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I didn't understand
of it, no.
I didn't understand, like I say, in places I wasn't quite sure what he was saying about. I found it a bit confusing what he was actually saying about how the human holograph is interacting with the, I'm not sure if you had a grasp of this.
Well, I don't think he really grasps it. He kind of suggests it's true, but doesn't really flesh it out.
Okay, good, because that was my thought. I was like,
yeah.
I think he's really on to something here, but I don't think he's sort of developed it, or he certainly hasn't developed it in the same terms that you have, and that's where I see the real value too. Like, you know, it's like going back to your commentary, like when Carl Prebram says there's no laser beam in the brain, you know, and this is where the heart doctrine really is differentiated from even those who are proposing the holographic theory to account for consciousness. There's no recognition that somehow this arises in the heart, and yet it's within all the mystical and spiritual teachings, which is an esoteric tradition, you know. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and the connection of consciousness to light, which is so invaluable, like there's this. Because then consciousness is light. Then we can imagine, oh yeah, if we awoke consciously, there would be more light, and we'd be illuminated, and it would illuminate more, and more illumination would reveal more and more. So the whole idea of consciousness as light, and then there's actual physics to that light, it's not only meant metaphorically, but it literally is light. Like in the esoteric traditions, the Jiva Atma is described by Swami Prabhupada as inherently self-illuminating like the sun. And the same idea in Blavatsky, where she talks of the monad as a spark of this divine fire and light that's kind of brought down to the material plane. So we have this idea that there is an inherently self-illuminating element within the human heart, and that's the basis of the human holograph. And then that light of the heart is distributed all through the chakra system and the channels and so on, all within the subtle anatomy, which is like the template underlying the physical anatomy. So the model of the chakras is so invaluable, and the fact that it's sevenfold, seven chakras, and you know how Blavatsky says when creation happens there are seven invisible points. So each chakra has a zero point center in a way. Each chakra has a radiating periphery, and then it has a zero point center, which is the kind of ultimate concentration of that energy. So there's this whole kind of system of zero point centers and light bodies in the subtle planes that underlie the physical body. So then when you throw down those iron filings on that piece of paper, they align in a certain way because the force fields are already there.
Yeah.
In the subtle bodies.
Yeah, and I have to forgive me because when I was
giving that last speech, I was feeding four cats at the same time. I don't know if that came through. I was a bit distracted, but yeah.
We're talking about consciousness as light and the idea of taking seriously the idea of there being a self-illuminating element within the human being. And
yeah, and that was one of the things. This is something that I realize that I think this is part of what obscures this idea to people. Is I think a lot of times when it's right there, really, about light, but I think this is also true of the heart in a sense. I think people take these things metaphorically when, on a certain level, they are meant metaphorically, but also they're meant literally, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's a metaphorical understanding, there's a physical light, and there's the metaphysical light, you know? And light, there's light that in your work, you refer to it as light small L, and then there's light big L, you know? The supernal light. And I think this is part, and I say the same thing about the heart. When people think, you know, people know things in their heart, they think, well, that's a metaphor. But it's also, it's a metaphor which, you know, metaphor is just something that stands for something, and it refers to really, in its higher dimensional meanings, it refers to the heart. It does refer to the heart, to the physical heart, and to the metaphysical heart.
Yeah, it's not really metaphor.
Yeah,
in a way, it's literally true.
Yeah.
We think is simply metaphor. Like, we think it, people, in modern science, they think emotions are caused by the limbic system in the head.
Yeah.
But how many people go home and tell their sweetheart, you know, I love you with all my head?
Yeah.
Like, people don't do it. People associate love intuitively. They connect it to the heart. So you might say, oh, someone, a modern scientist will say, oh, that's only metaphor that you love people with your heart or you have compassion with your heart. But in the mystical tradition, no, they're saying no, it's literally, physically true. There's a physics to it.
Yeah. But even in terms of like hormones that circulate through the bloodstream, I mean, that's the other thing that's kind of sort of overlooked a lot of, is that a lot of what our state of consciousness and emotional state is determined by these things that are carried in the blood and in which modern science recognizes. So I'd say that's one of the more important ideas too, is that in terms of understanding consciousness, is to understand the importance of the circulation of blood and how blood is intimately related to consciousness. I think that's a huge thing that's not recognized, and the blood goes everywhere basically, you know, like without circulation of blood, we have no life. It's that simple. But also too, it's like our experience of our consciousness, our physical consciousness is intimately related to the blood flow, you know. And even as you pointed out many times, what's the modern technique for studying imaging in the brain is to study blood flow. So I mean, that's another aspect that's completely misunderstood about the nature of consciousness, is we have to understand it in terms of like physical blood, but also that then there's, you know, that everything physical has sort of its metaphysical higher dimensional counterparts, and that's what's not recognized.
I like Gurdjieff's way of explaining how there's also astral blood. The blood of the ass of the Kesjan body, and then there's the kind of mental body blood, which is like the light energetic life energies in the subtle dimensions. So the physical blood's not simply the physical blood, but it's also the blood of the subtle bodies that supports consciousness within the body.
Yeah.
Like, it's very interesting when people have, like, near-death experiences, and all of a sudden the person finds himself outside of their body witnessing the event of their medical emergency. And when these people are outside of their body, they usually report feeling almost completely themselves. They still are able to kind of think and analyze a situation, like they see family, friends there, or they know what people are doing or saying in the other room. So they're still mentally awake and functioning. They're still conscious. They still have memory of kind of what's happened to who they are and who people are and so on. So they're outside of their body and they feel almost completely themselves. So what this suggests is even when we're in our bodies and we think our experience of ourselves is being produced by the physical, it's not. It never was. the inner experience of being is not something that's a product of the physical body. It's something more subtle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that it's never produced by the physical body. Prabhupada says life comes from life.
Life, yeah.
Yeah, life doesn't evolve out of matter. Life, in a way, comes from above. Life comes from life, and then it inhabits a physical body. Like, I like how Swami Prabhupada says, thinking the physical body produces consciousness is like studying a person's clothes and thinking that the clothes is the individual, whereas really it's just their covering. Well, similarly, studying the body and thinking that that is the self is like studying a person's clothes, not, yeah.
Yeah, and again, we've discussed this before, but, you know, come back to it because it's such an important point, but in the materialist reductionist perspective, which dominates most of modern science and definitely dominates consciousness research, what you have is you have this, like, this approach where you're trying to understand how is consciousness produced by these non-sentient material processes and these dumb material processes, for lack of a better word. How does consciousness emerge from these? And this is the huge conundrum which faces consciousness researchers. And that's the problem, is that they try to explain everything from the bottom up. Now, within consciousness research, there are people like Penrose who talks about top-down causation, and he, to a certain extent, says that consciousness is an emergent property, and that there are hierarchical aspects of consciousness where consciousness does, in some ways, guide and organize lower processes. But nobody really talks about involutionary processes versus evolutionary processes. That is, like, these higher dimensional, higher being bodies informing and directing and organizing lower levels, that is, in the human being, the material processes. Like, nobody ever talks about things coming from the top down. And I think that's really what's lacking in the explanatory framework of modern sciences, and especially consciousness research. Like, everybody wants to explain everything from the ground up. But, you know, clearly, the evidence suggests that everything we talked about the human body before applies to consciousness. Everything suggests that the whole problem of trying to explain things from the bottom up disappears if you understand that, well, that's not where consciousness comes from. Consciousness comes from above. It doesn't come from below.
Yeah.
And as you say, life comes from life, and consciousness comes from consciousness. Consciousness comes from higher consciousness, you know, like,
yeah.
human consciousness is an expression of some higher dimensional levels of consciousness and being, which is stepped down through various gradations and manifests through the heart, through the blood, through the chakras, in the physical body, and informs the human being. But as I say, this idea that we're multidimensional beings, that they have these higher dimensions, that model, I think, addresses so many of the basic problems that confront modern science and the study of psychology and the study of physiology and medicine and, you know, biology. It's amazing in a way that people don't recognize it and don't even see it. Eh? Like, I mean, I find it hard reading the history of science to understand, like, where did this go off the rails so badly? Like, people have become so infatuated with this perspective of, you know, that everything's kind of moves from the simple to the complex, that there's sort of, you know, like Gurdjieff says, we're third force blind. Well, we're even just sort of second force blind in this case, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting how it happened within science. And it's like when science emerged, they kind of saw religion as their foe, kind of, because religion was based on belief and dogmas and such. And so they saw life coming from matter rather than life coming from a spiritual realm or spiritual world. So
Yeah. Well, it, actually, it was quite a complicated process because originally most of the major figures of the birth of modern science were very religious, and you know, late Newton and Kepler and Bruno and a variety of these thinkers all sort of made room for God and yeah. for spirit, and it then under the deists, I guess, in the 18th century, sort of everything was, God was moved outside of everything, sort of God set everything in motion, and then natural laws took over, and then eventually in the 19th and 20th century, God was removed from the equation altogether, and spirit was done away with,
with the rise of Darwinian evolutionary theory, which purported to account for the evolution of life and consciousness based purely on physical processes.
Yeah, I was reading one of the papers, one of the last papers in Laszlo's book, he's talking about the history of the idea of the world soul and how this, you know, transformed in different philosophical and scientific traditions. And he's talking about Kepler. And Kepler was 1571 to 1630. And Kepler was influenced by esoteric ideas, clearly. And I remember in particular something like, I think he was really influenced by the Pythagorean ideas about the harmony of the spheres. He says in his work on elliptical orbits of the planets, Kepler proposed a theory of universal gravitation, the second field of modern physics. In his explanation of non-circular motion, he actually changed the word spirit as an angelic influence to force, that is mechanism, in the manuscript for his most important work, Astronomia Nova of 1609. And here we may locate the death of the world soul concomitant with the birth of modern physics. So here's, you know, that's really interesting because here's somebody who is clearly influenced by these esoteric ideas and by religious ideas, but the translation went from spirit to force. So you have, it's like the de-sacralization, the de-divinization of natural laws. And so there's no room for spirit or for God. This is just sort of excluded, not on the basis of any evidence, but on the basis of philosophical idealism and the idea of natural law being to explain the physical world as being devoid of spirit. But there's nothing like, it's like I say in my work, it's like, you know, modern science didn't disprove spirit or the existence of God or animism or any of these ideas. It banished them, you know, rather than disproving them. It's not based on evidence. It's based on intellectual choices to conform with a certain ideal.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, so he changed it from spirit to force. It's interesting how, like, when I consider the teaching of the secret doctrine, the manner in which it works, there's seven spiritual intelligences, Blavatsky says, in higher dimensional space. And these seven spiritual intelligences, they channel their intelligences brought down by what Blavatsky calls Fohat. Fohat runs circular errands. So Fohat becomes the force, which is a manifestation of the spiritual intelligence. So you have the spiritual intelligence, and then that intelligence is embodied in the force, which then organizes matter. So you have body, soul, and spirit, like the three, whereas kind of with what you were saying, it turned it into a duality of matter and force, and they denied the spirit. Whereas in the mystical perspective, there's spirit, soul, and body, the threefoldness.
Yeah, there's a, in also in that Laszlo book, there's a nice quote from, I think from Hazad Inayat Khan, where he's saying that really spirit and matter can be compared to water and ice. You know, they're essentially the same thing, but in two different states, and that, you know, the distinction to oppose them is really based on a failure to recognize that there's something which unifies them, you know, and that is that there's really just different manifestations, which is, a, you know, when you think about it, it's a, like it's such a strikingly different understanding of the nature of everything if you're willing to sort of entertain that perspective and to open your mind to, it's like getting back to your point earlier about education. It's like you have to unlearn a lot of things to learn these days because you're taught so much, so many things that are really presented as based on, a clearer understanding based on scientific evidence, but it's not. Like, people are really quite blind to the history of the evolution of modern science and how so many of these things are based really on intellectual choices and philosophical idealism and very subjective variables rather than objective evidence. There's no objective evidence for any of these things, you know?
and it's also the case, see, part of the problem also for the scientists is that really there is so much scientific evidence for paranormal phenomena, from ghosts, out-of-body experiences, descriptions of mystical and psychical experiences, psychical and spiritual healing, ESP, psychokinesis. There's so much evidence for all these kinds of phenomena.
Yeah.
So really, those people who kind of think they're the real scientists because they have a materialist perspective, really what they're doing is closing their eyes to all these enigmas and claims and reports, which are all evidences suggesting, no, there's something far deeper. We're not, the head scientists have made a fundamental mistake. You know, people can exist outside of their body. There are ghosts. There is an existence beyond death. You know, there are psychical forces. People are interconnected somehow through space.
Yeah, it's interesting because isn't it in Tertium Organum where Uspensky says like 100 years ago he said something about, is it in Tertium Organum or New Model of the Universe where he says if you added up together all the system destroying facts, it would do away with the modern materialist perspective. It's in one of those books.
It's in, I think, Tertium Organum.
And
wash away everything we think we knew.
We think we knew, and that was like 100 years ago, you know.
Yeah, and it's still true, kind of.
Oh, it's.
I mean, it is to the mainstream of science.
Yeah, and really, that was like 100 years ago before you had, like, you know, with the development the whole development of 20th century physics, but also like the development of things like resuscitation techniques, which allow people to report on near death experiences. You have so much more. I would say, such like a more convincing body of evidence.
Yeah, you do
from a variety of disciplines, from like these psychic phenomena, not to mention something like the. All of the parapsychological research, which Dean Radin says, you know, like is, if you analyze it properly statistically, you know, is overwhelmingly confirms the existence of psychic phenomena. Not to mention, like I say, 20th century physics. Not to mention all these conundrums that all these enigmas in modern biology. You know, like I mean, it's the evidence is growing all the time and showing us that. You know, we have to think in radically different ways about these things.
Yeah, it certainly does. And that's what's so good about Laszlo's book, is he's kind of arrived at that. He kind of knows, you know, we have to look at, try to understand the nature of space or the ether and understand information as third force and in science. He doesn't use that term exactly. I want to give one example I thought from Laszlo's book, which was a curious case study, which I think demonstrates the unusual nature of what is being suggested by this kind of science. But he discusses the talents of an idiot savant, an individual who is supposed to be below normal functioning in intelligence and adjustment, but who... This man can speak 7 languages, compute cube roots as fast as a calculator, and recall the constant pi to 22,514 decimal places. they probably stopped at that point when he got to. Now, how could some person compute pi to 22,000 decimal places? Okay, and this is like an idiot savant. So it's not someone who's gone through academic training and learned the science and learned all about math and can now compute cube roots. Like people who go through all the science education, none of them can compute cube roots as fast as the calculator. So what is it? Like how, and in a way what it, the answer, in a way, I think, in Laszlo, what he's saying is, like, we live in these information fields, and potentially all the information of the universe is present everywhere, because it's all kind of holographically connected and interconnected, all within the ethers. So, yeah, and that's his concept of the Akasha. So somehow this idiot savant, he's kind of tapping, he taps this kind of information field, like it's something beyond himself. It's not, is this information field the product of material processes in his brain? No, that, of course not. You see, it's not a material process in his brain where he's computing these cube roots. Instead, he's kind of drawing directly, tapping into the information field of the Akasha. So this information, like, I remember one experience when I had a period of kind of, I've had different periods in life where I thought I've experienced different kinds of enlightenments and realizations and things. And at one point, I had the experience that it's like whatever I cast my mind into, it was like I could cast my mind into things and the answers and things would just be revealed to me. And it would be like I would see into things. And it was like having that thought, like all that information is there. It's kind of tapping those information fields that are present within the space we're in. And it all kind of relates to what Blavatsky says, which is the quote in the Secret Doctrine. She says that there is one omniscience, yeah, which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. So that at some level in the information fields within space, there's all that information and intelligence latent everywhere. In a way, within yourself, within the space you're in, you could know about the evolution of humankind. Like Groff describes in some of his LSD experiences, where he wakens and kind of experiences himself being in these different forms through evolution, even in non-human forms. Like that information and experience, in a way, is all, it's like we all have a black hole computer within the heart, a higher dimensional black hole computer. And it's got semi little 0 points. And this micro element in the higher dimensional physics of the heart, somehow the light of that can illuminate, what am I trying to say? I lost a little bit what I was trying to say. But all, so the idea, I'm going to try to unravel this a bit. I was saying about how the first idea was about how there's this omniscience or all this intelligence and information present everywhere within space. Okay, and that's holographic space. That's the idea. Holographic means to write the whole. So it's like information about the whole is present everywhere within the whole. So we exist within this holographic field. So Laszlo has that concept. What he lacks then is the concept that we have a zero point center of ourselves as a being. And in my work, I try to explain how this monadic essence, I would say, is like a little atom in a way in higher dimensions, a monad in seven-dimensional hyperspace. And that in this monad, Blavatsky says there are seven holes dug in space. So there's seven little mini holes dug in space, in higher dimensional space. And in modern physics, scientists have the concept of how mini black holes could process huge amounts of information down at Planckian levels. This is concept that has emerged in modern ideas about computer technology and information science. Mini black holes could be information processors. So Blavatsky's saying there's an element within the human being that has these seven little mini holes dug in space at zero point levels. So you have this little microprocessor in you. It's your little eye, and it exists in seven-dimensional hyperspace. It's not something you can see within four-dimensional space-time around you. Okay, it exists within a higher-dimensional space within your heart space. And this is a microcomputer element, or your individual eye chip. And that's your monad, your God spark, and it exists in this higher dimensions. It doesn't exist in the four-dimensional space-time because it's within the higher-dimensional space which underlies four-dimensional space-time, and that's your essential I. And that element is then clothed. You might imagine different bodies forming around it in circles, kind of. And it kind of is embodied in different skins. So Blavatsky says the monad exists within seven-skinned eternal parent space. So hyperspace is seven-dimensional. So when that little monad spins in hyperspace, it then begins to create bodies or material around itself. And then of different densities, one after the other, successively. So it's embodied in seven gradients of matter through the ethers. And so there's so such ideas, like this is trying to get at a, you know, more advanced model of what a human being is as a holographic system. I'm saying we got these little microprocessor computer elements, a monad in seven-dimensional hyperspace, and it has spin properties, and the spin properties break the symmetries in the ethers surrounding the central point, which creates matter. It's like the descent of light in the tree of life. As it comes down, it creates different forms of matter successively through different planes of existence. So life comes from above and we come down into the physical. So this monad in hyperspace spins away, and its spin properties bear a certain equivalence to the bodies that form around it. So I was saying about Laszlo. So the idea is about what we're saying is, there's an omniscience which thrills throughout eternity, an omniscience which thrills throughout every finite point of the cosmos. So there's this information field that's infinitely rich, that we exist within that, and we have a zero-point center within the higher-dimensional physics of the heart. So there's a whole... different concepts about the heart are most important, that this monadic essence in hyperspace, and then the concept that within the heart there is a vacated space. And this, in Kabbalistic teachings, it refers to what's called the zimzum, the self-contraction, that when the infinite God created a little finite being, the infinite God had to vacate a volume of space, which kind of created apparent nothingness. Okay, because if the infinite swallowed up, otherwise the infinite would swallow up everything. So the infinite had to vacate an empty space for a finite being to come into existence. So partly the physics of the heart has to do with the idea that there's a vacated space within the heart. So this is a, you know, so I'm saying that there are, the heart is something that exists in relationship to hyperspace dimensions. So this is the idea, this is a more advanced model of like a holographic model in psychology or philosophy, is that there's actually, and there's actually a seven little holes dug in space as a microprocessor within the human heart. That this is consistent, this is an idea consistent with the esoteric teachings, but kind of framed in terms of the ideas of modern science. Jim, am I making any sense?
Oh, yeah, well, I think so, but I'm not sure everybody's understanding it all, but it's kind of like, you know, it's not easily understood, but here's something that sort of triggered. I mean, this idea from Blavatsky about the omniscience that thrills through every atom, every finite point is really like, I mean, it's a holographic model, too, because, like, the intelligence thrills through the points, but the points are all within the intelligence. Like, so the whole is in the parts, and the parts are in the whole. It's a holographic formulation.
Yeah.
Here's St. Bonaventure, who was one of the early church fathers who articulated the Platonic tradition. He said, this is in Laszlo's book. He spoke frequently of the Fontalis Plenitudo, or the fountain fullness in the Trinity and the fecundity of the Father. But this fecundity comes from a void, a privation or negative aspect of the Father, who comes from no one, no thing, is unbegotten and without origin. From this privation or nothingness comes the primacy of the Father and the power and the plenitude following in the Trinity, flowing in the Trinity. And so he's like... He says, whosoever is not enlightened by such splendor who created things is blind. Whosoever is not awakened by such outcries is deaf. Whoever does not praise God because of all these effects is dumb. Whoever does not discover the first principle from such clear signs is a fool. And then in the, it goes on, he says, in the deepest part of the mind, heart, and soul of the human person is hidden the image of the Trinity in memory, understanding, and will, representing the three persons of the Trinity.
Memory, understanding, and will, yeah.
And then, you know, in 16th and 17th century English literature, I remember reading this in Jonathan Cott, there was a tradition of poems being composed in three stanzas. Each one was devoted to memory, in the order of memory, understanding, and will. So, like, these ideas, it's interesting, hey, like, I mean, in terms of, like, the law of three, how these ideas are in so many things, and yet people don't recognize them, you know. And this idea of the void as being the plenum—it's in so many different teachings. But you really have to kind of be aware of it to recognize it. Eh? Like it's difficult in a sense that it's there, but until you have a certain sophistication and understanding of it, you can't kind of see it. I just wanted to say,
yeah, it's neat. It just enriches our understanding of mystical literature to have these ideas of modern physics.
Well, and you just realize how sophisticated these teachings are, right? Like
mm-hmm.
Blavatsky's teaching. I mean, because you read these ideas in modern physics, you say, oh, yeah, well, that's really fascinating, but, you know, Blavatsky said this in 1888 in The Secret Doctrine, you know?
Yeah.
And she got it from traditions that were thousands of years old. I mean, she didn't invent it in 1888. These ideas have been around for literally thousands of years.
Yeah. And so she had those ideas in kind of physics and metaphysics. And then what's so amazing is like how Blavatsky's model then applies to ourselves and to consciousness. Like it's not, in modern science, you have these ideas in physics, but no one kind of thinks that they apply in a certain way to human beings.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the big part that's missing. The other thing this is from, also from, Laszlo. He's talking about the vacuum theories as being the vacuum, quantum vacuum being the most fundamental field of the universe. And he says it glues quarks, stabilizes atoms and solar systems, and creates mass as well as the forces of inertia and gravitation. It connects all things with all other things. And then he talks about Russell Puthoff and who also worked with Bernard Haysch, who we talked about a few sessions ago on the God theory. Puthoff says, on the cosmological scale, a grand hand-in-glove equilibrium exists between the ever-agitated motion of matter on the quantum level and the surrounding zero-point energy field. One consequence of this is that we are literally, physically, in touch with the rest of the cosmos, as we share with remote parts of the universe fluctuating zero-point fields of even cosmological dimensions. So this is how and Edgar Mitchell, he goes on, Edgar Mitchell says that the quantum vacuum is a holographic information field that records the historical experience of matter. So this is how, these are modern scientific concepts which are showing how the material physical world is intimately related to these higher dimensional realities and in ways that allow for the kind of experiences that the mystics describe when they describe, being at one with the cosmos. Like, people always kind of poo-poo this idea, skeptics and secular thinkers, we're one with the cosmos, ha-ha, that's very funny, and they think it's meant metaphorically, but here's the more the evolved ideas become about the quantum vacuum, the more you see how this is completely plausible in terms of modern scientific thinking. It's not contradicted. There's nothing in this that contradicts by contrast. It really underlies how completely logical these things are. And as you've said, it really shows how the need to kind of try to understand, to go beyond the current models of things and to understand how this happens in a human being. And that's where I think your work is incredibly useful and is groundbreaking in a sense, is that this idea that somehow we're related through these zero-point origins exist within human beings is a very, very profound idea.
Yeah.
It makes eminent sense, it just fits, Yeah.
And the idea of the vacated space
vacated
in the
space.
Heart, that is so deep. That is so deep. That's a basic Kabbalistic teaching. That's a Zimzum contraction.
That
always reminds me of Jean-Paul Sartre's philosophy, where he talks about it from his book called Being and Nothingness. And how he said the thing about human consciousness is that consciousness is a kind of nothingness. And he says, whenever we are conscious, we're always conscious of something. Like, I can see a telephone, I can see a grapefruit. We're always conscious of something which consciousness is not. But consciousness is not the apple, it's not the speaker, it's not the thoughts, it's not the feelings, it's not the sensations, it's not the volitions, it's not the desires. It's not everything.
Yeah.
And yet it still is as a something.
Yeah.
So it's most useful to think of consciousness as light and space, and the kind of mystical conjunction of the source of divine light existing within seven-dimensional hyperspace, that consciousness is this illumination that can illuminate matters within these different levels of the quantum vacuum or the zero-point fields. So consciousness is like light, and it illuminates, and then there are these matters formed out of the seven skins of the ether. So consciousness can be aware within these different realms of the ethers, within different worlds. So it's that kind of mystical conjunction. Consciousness, so it's like to understand consciousness in a way, I think it's most useful to understand the idea of nothingness at the heart of being, and the idea of consciousness as light and illumination. And that consciousness, so understanding light, understanding space,
I want to go back to that example that you were using about the idiot savant and how this, the idea like the Akashic record existing so that somebody could tap into that. And it's like, another example of that is the work of John Lorber, who studied people who supposedly had very usually were hydrocephalic, and which means that their brain was basically liquid, and that they had very studies of people with very, very underdeveloped cerebral cortexes who, according to the conventional understanding of things, should have been essentially unintelligent and should have been profoundly retarded, indicate that people can have, very, very high IQs and can be quite brilliant. And again, sort of challenge the conventional wisdom is that, you have to have a highly developed and intact cerebral cortex to be intelligent and to, have normal human consciousness. But Lorber's work, again, challenges that idea and really provides another set of kind of anomalistic data that really don't fit the conventional model. And then another thing that Laszlo discusses, which we've discussed this before, but it's the whole idea of people, what's going on when people recall past lives. And I mean, there's really, I think even people who are skeptical would look at Ian Stevenson's work at 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation and say that there's, he provides pretty compelling evidence that something that we don't understand is going on. One of the points Laszlo makes is that because somebody can recall a past life doesn't necessarily mean that they live that life, but that they may have access to this information in the Akashic record by some process we clearly don't understand. So again, all of these different phenomena suggest that somehow everything that's happening in the material plane is interacting with these higher dimensions. I mean, he talks about strictly in terms of the Akashic record. I would say that the possibility that maybe that there are, different levels of this and different dimensions of this, but that where information is, everything is recorded and that these things could be accessed. But, it's an interesting alternative to the idea that, that our memory is produced by the workings of the neurological processes in the brain.
And that
as he says, memory is extrasomatic. And I mean, he actually also says...
Extrasomatic, yes.
Yeah.
Memory is extrasomatic.
Which I think,
beyond
I
the
think
physical.
Is right. I think that fits kind of. And then he's also saying that, then in a way, he's talking about the idea of multiple universes and why is the universe so finely tuned to allow for for itself to exist as it is? And he says, he goes into the whole idea of that's popular and the variety of proposals of this about multiverses is that we've had, several different universes that have been created. And his explanation is really interesting, is that the current universe, our universe, is the product. It's a record of inheritances that successive attempts have been made, and each time, the universe itself evolves in a sense, and the information is recorded from previous occurrences, and that the universe that we experience is a result of memory and evolution in the sense of coordinated development and fulfilling of this process of creation. So it's like it's a very, very different idea, as to rather than just like a big bang happened
yeah.
and our universe happened. He's saying no, there have been many successive occurrences of the universe, and that's why the so many of the cosmological constants are so finely tuned to allow, if they were off by just, even the smallest.
A billionth, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he has a great quote in there from Roger Penrose that something to the effect that the likelihood of our universe arising is so ridiculously remote that it can't even be entertained as a hypothesis. I actually can find that.
He says about it's as likelihood as a hurricane blowing through a
Fred
junkyard
Hoyle.
And assembling a jet plane.
That's Fred Hoyle, yeah. But
oh, that's Fred
Penrose
Hoyle.
Says, when talking about the finely tuned Was the finely tuned primal explosion merely a lucky fluke, or was it the work of a transcendental creator? Creationists believe the latter, while cosmologists have opted for the former. Yet the statistical probabilities speak against the serendipity thesis. According to Roger Penrose's calculations, the probability of hitting on a universe such as ours by random selection from among the possible alternatives is 1 in 10 to the 10th to the 123rd. This is an inconceivably large number, and it points to an improbability that hardly merits being taken seriously. And then he has that great example of what happens if a blind person it tries to solve Rubik's Cube, and he gives the example that if the person just blindly does it, it would take them more time than the history of the universe to solve it strictly on a completely random basis. But if you provide them with feedback as to each move that they make, a blind person can solve it in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, speaks to the idea that...
There's feedback built in, so things aren't random.
Yeah, it's an essential feature of the evolution of anything. The intelligence that informs the material universe relies on feedback, and so there's this constant exchange of information between the material plane and these higher-order fields of intelligence. And I'd say that's exactly what happens in the human body, too, is that you have this ongoing, dynamic exchange of information with the physical processes that are occurring in the human body,
and these subtle energy fields
are programmed by your genes. I mean, that's completely ridiculous to try to explain things on it solely in terms of genetic inheritance, because it's much more dynamic and open ended than that too. Because as I say, the actual atoms are turning over all the time, so it's not actually in the information, and the intelligence isn't in the material processes. Really, material processes are all sort of fluctuations that are occurring in keeping with this, you know, with these higher order intelligence.
Yeah, they're informed somehow.
Yeah.
Guided.
So like you say, it's like trying to understand, why are those filings moving around on that paper like that, not understanding that there's a magnet under there that's creating these force fields which you're organizing it? It's just,
they even have that idea in modern science of there being such centers. Sometimes they're called strange attractors. Have you ever heard that phrase?
Yeah.
From chaos theory, where it is as if there is a strange attractor, a center somewhere, that gives rise to the forms. They're called strange attractors. So I'm saying that human beings have these strange attractors in the art.
Yeah.
Yeah, within these fields of chaos, kind of.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, reading this book is, I think it's a really, really interesting book, Laszlo's book, and his other book that I've read, too, on the Akashic Field is really interesting. But I found the discussion in this book to be really profound. Like, I mean, there's some really, really good papers in this, you know. I'd highly recommend this to anybody who's stuck with us this long to pick up a copy of Irvin Laszlo's Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos. The subtitle is The Rise of the Integral Vision of Reality, or any of his other books. I mean, he's got a lot of different books, but this is really good. This is published by Inner Traditions in Rochester, Vermont. So, definitely worth. There was one other quick point I wanted to make too about this. That really, again, this goes back to something talking about what's known in consciousness study is the hard problem David Chalmers asked, which is how can something as immaterial as consciousness arise from something as unconscious as matter? And this is what he calls the hard problem. It's a perplexing problem for his philosopher Jerry Fedor pointed out, quote, "Nobody has the slightest idea how anything material could be conscious. Nobody even knows what it would be like to have the slightest idea about how it could be conscious." So my, unquote. So my response to that is like, oh yeah? You know, like, I think that, I think that there are people who have studied consciousness throughout
Have
history,
ideas of that.
Have a slight idea of how anything material could be conscious. I mean, that to me, if he's talking about modern consciousness researchers, I'd say, yeah, I mean, they're clueless.
That's true,
you know, like, they're completely
unconscious. Yeah, they have no idea.
No idea.
Completely inexplicable, even how to define what it is.
And yeah. And
any agreement about it.
And the fact that, you know, that the Chalmers presented this definition of a hard problem at a conference, you know, 10 years ago in Arizona or something, and everybody, oh, this is an incredible insight. I'm thinking, you know, this is an incredible insight. You guys are reading the wrong books, you know. Like, I mean, you know, that's why I say it's funny how, you know, people who regard themselves as being skeptical, rationalists, and poo-poo all the new age ideas and anything that smacks of anything which challenges a materialist explanation of things, that they're always kind of like, you know, holding themselves up as occupying the intellectual high ground. But in a way, like, for anybody who's done any studying of the esoteric tradition, you realize what a bunch of phonies. Like, I mean, that this is intellectually indefensible to proclaim yourself, you know, a skeptical, a rationalist materialist, that you've somehow exhaustively researched these questions and know everything about them, you know, because these people don't have a clue as to the nature of the esoteric tradition, which provides this completely lucid, insightful, profound.
Yeah, it's a whole kind of science of the soul that people have no idea of
and
has been suppressed for a long time.
You know, should check himself into the nearest library and start reading these books. You know, he'd find out there's all sorts of people who have ideas about how anything material could be conscious. You know,
people aren't exposed to the ideas generally.
He's just blindfolded by his education. And to get back to your letter writer's question, education is important, but, you know, there's education and there's education. It's what kind of education?
Yeah.
There's so much of becoming conscious consists of unlearning and, uneducating yourself to a certain extent, and beginning to question the authority of everything that you've been taught and to try to understand it in a completely different way.
And that's what we've been trying to do today on Zero Point Radio.
Yeah.
This has been James Moffat and Christopher Holmes in our 2-hour Zero Point Radio show. We hope you've enjoyed the day. A Sufi sage says, "Not since God brought man out of nothingness have we ceased to be travelers." That's interesting. So this idea of the nothingness and consciousness and light and how the universe might be a holographic nature. And I'm saying there's actually a little mini microchip element in hyperspace that is at the core of your being. And that there's actually a science and physics to this, and that we are multidimensional beings that live lives in different planes of the ethers. So encourage listeners to try to live in light and love and truth and face dangerous times upon us and the craziness and madness of humankind on the international scheme and all the criminal things being done in the world and such. And keep faith, hope, and love that we can change the world. And I think it all begins with trying to know ourselves and remember we need to attain to our souls. Remember this and try to see what's significant in your life and what's not, and let some things fall away and come back to yourself. Okay, thanks, Jim.
Yep, thanks, Chris.
Okay, thanks, BBS Radio.
Thanks, Doug.
I encourage listeners, please visit zeropoint.ca, my website. I've been trying to revise it lately again and put some new materials up there, and I've just revising Zero Point Teaching, that book of my work, which is a lot of my writings and political writings, and also I'm making available CDs of the BBS radio shows from different years. I want to make those available to people. Okay, thank you very much, and remember yourself and try to have courage, which means having a new heart. Okay, thank you, BBS. Thank you all.
Yeah, thanks.
Goodbye.
Bye.